Want to call the meeting to order of the House Committee on Rules for Wednesday, June 5th. I want to thank everyone for being here. We have a number of things on the agenda, and we're going to move through as quickly and orderly as possible. And I'm just going to tell you what the order is going to be so that people know. First, we'll hear LC 4014, the ERA amendment, then SCR 17, then we'll hear HCR 33, then we'll have a public hearing on SCR 3A, and after that, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3390. So that's the order, and with that, I would like to open a work session for the introduction of committee measures.
Madam Chair.
Can I just briefly mention which one it is? Members of the committee, you have LC 4014, the draft proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution relating to equal rights. The proposed referral would go out for approval or rejection at the next primary election.
Madam Chair, I move that LC 4014, dated June 3rd, 2013, be introduced as a committee bill.
Vice Chair Hicks moves that LC 4014, dated 6-3-2013, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Okay, I'd like to open a public hearing and work session on SCR 17. Representative Cameron.
And members of the committee, SCR 17 is a memorial to Mike McLaren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Representative Kevin Cameron, representing House District 19, South Salem, East Rural Salem, Almsville, and Turner. And I just wanted to introduce SCR 17. It's a memorial recognizing Mike McLaren, who is a great leader not only here in Salem but throughout the entire state of Oregon, and I urge your support of this memorial.
Sorry.
I'm done.
That's it?
Right. Just pass the bill and we're going to get it onto the House floor.
Okay. Are there any questions, comments? Representative, I want to thank you very much. And right now we're in a work session, so I'd entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move SCR 17 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Hicks moves SCR 17 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? If not, the motion passes and SCR 17 is adopted. Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
Carry. Oh, and Representative Cameron, would you like to carry the
bill? I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Okay. With that, I want to open a public hearing and a work session on HCR 33. Would like to call Representative Matthews.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, HCR 33 commends 2012 Gresham National Little League team for earning its first berth to the Little League World Series.
Would you like a permission to use some visual aids?
I didn't know that was mandatory, Madam Chair, but sure. Can I request unanimous consent to use a visual aid or three or four?
So ordered.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Greg Matthews, State Representative, House District 50, which is the great city of Gresham, and the proud home of the 2012 Northwest Regional Tournament Champions, Gresham Little League team. Before you today, I brought a few props, just for explanation. These two things you can find in my office at any given time. They're both autographed baseballs. To explain the difference, this one, that's autographed by Representative Jim Widener. I have no idea he gave it to me. I have no reason. This one's actually autographed by athletes. And and today on HCR 33, I just want to tell you, I understand how important the work that you're doing is. I get that that we have things stacked up, and I won't be long, but I want to tell you why I think it's so important to recognize these kids. You can read the resolution, you can read the whereas statements, and it's all there. But the bottom line is, this is a group of kids from our community that, if you know anything about Little League, and if you've grown up in Little League, baseball, softball, it just pulls the community together like never before. And there's only been four teams from Oregon that have made the Little League World Series, and one of those is this team, the 2012 champions. Cards are stacked against them in every game. They came back swinging. They're an amazing team. It didn't work out for them. They didn't win the World Series, but they got to the dance, and it's a pretty amazing feat. What I want to brag about isn't just the kids, but the fact of how they got there. They got there because there were coaches that cared a great deal about these kids. They got there first because there were parents that allowed these kids to be involved in positive alternatives out there and supported them through their endeavors. And then they got there because there was a community that thought, you know what? It's not right to have these kids make it that far for the parents to be left behind. Everybody goes on their own dime to this show. It's amazing. Coaches take time off of work to go coach these kids. The worst thing that can happen is almost you win the whole thing because you stayed there the whole time and you're on the hook for the entire hotel fee, win or lose. And so what the town of Gresham did was when they won the Northwest Regional Tournament, they had a spaghetti fundraiser out in the middle of 3rd and Main Street. Our very own Mayor Shane Bemis owns a restaurant called Bocelli's. I recommend you eat there someday. He provided the spaghetti. We actually ran out of noodles within about an hour and 10 minutes. It was ridiculous. Sonny Hans got together, cooked more noodles, started making teriyaki chicken. Local cow around the corner decided, small little restaurant. Hey, we want to do this tomorrow. We raised about $15,000 to $20,000 in just those two evenings activities, and we gave it to those parents so that they could attend the game to see their kids. I don't know if you're aware how this Little League system works. These kids win the game, they go home and pack, and they're on their plane. And the parents are left with saying, how do we get there? So this isn't just about like this team, this is about this community. And it's just an amazing deal. So HCR 33, while I know it's not as important as some of the other bills we pass, it's really important to Gresham. It's really important to me. And when you see these kids, and hopefully they can make it to the House floor. If not, we'll give it to them on the diamond. But the bottom line is, these are just kids. Tyler Lynch is a kid I've known since he was probably a year old. He's on ESPN talking to this beautiful reporter about how he eats Dairy Queen as kind of a, that's his deal. He's got to have chicken strips for every game with a vanilla cone. She gives him the chocolate one. What's he say to her? No. Vice Chair Hicks, you and I would say thank you. He says, no, I like vanilla. But when you just get to the heart and soul of these kids, they're just kids. And this is, you know, again, in the scope of things that we'll do in this session, not a huge ask. Pretty simple. But it's a big deal to Gresham. It's a big deal to Little League. And it's just big to every kid across the country that's ever dreamed of making it to the big dance. And so I'm proud of the fact the kids played. I'm proud of how they represented themselves on a national stage. These kids were everything good about Gresham, and they showed it. And they even got to play. They're the first U.S. team to play Uganda. And they actually were the first U.S. team to lose to Uganda. But the manner in which they did so, they were so classy. We could all learn from these 12-year-old kids and the way they conduct themselves, not only in victory, but in defeat. And so that's why this bill comes to you late. It wasn't at the top of the priority list, but it certainly was something that I thought we should try to find room for. You have done that for me today, and I thank you and applaud you for that. And with that, I'd take any questions. But again, really appreciate you taking the time today on HCR 33.
Questions? Comments? Representative, what I was most impressed with was the good sportsmanship of those players who were so young, and yes, they didn't win, but they were great sports and really represented your city well, and I think this is a wonderful memorial. So,
Madam Chair, I move HCR 33 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Hicks moves HCR 33 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? If not, then the motion passes and HCR 33 is adopted. And Representative Matthews, would you be interested in carrying this bill?
I'd be honored, Madam Chair, and I'll also put my autographed Jim Widener baseball next to the autographed Jim Widener football, which, again, makes no sense, but I appreciate the good representative.
Lucky man.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, thank you.
Okay, thank you. So, close the work session on HCR 33 and open a public hearing and work session on SCR 3A.
They're going to go next. This is it. And then we'll click on.
Okay, and with that, we'll call up the first panel, Jan Elfers, Wadi Saeed, Rabbi Daniel Itzak, and Patty Whitney Weiss.
And whichever one of you would like to start first, start, and then we'll...
I'll start about yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Jan Elfers. I'm the Public Policy Director for Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. We are a statewide Christian and, organization with interfaith partners throughout the state. I'm speaking today on the behalf of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and our Executive Director, David Leslie, who was unable to make it today. I'd first of all just like to introduce this interfaith panel. I'll let Patty introduce herself, but to my right, I'd like to introduce Mr. Waji Saeed, who is the president and co-founder of the Muslim Educational Trust and has worked with the Muslim community as well as the larger community to promote a better understanding of Islam. He's a co-founder of the Interfaith Council of Greater Portland, as well as co-founder of the Arab-Jewish-Muslim Dialogue, the Institute for Christian-Muslim Understanding, Islamic Social Services of Oregon State, and the Arab-Muslim Police Advisory Board. And then I'd also like to introduce Rabbi Daniel Isaac, who is the senior rabbi at Congregation Neve Shalom in Portland, Oregon. He has just completed his second term as president of the Board of Rabbis. He is also helped to organize the Muslim-Jewish-Arab dialogue after 9/11, and he works very closely with IMO on social issues. With that, I'd just like to say a couple of words in support of SCR3 honoring Emily Gottfried. Emily Gottfried was a Jewish woman of faith and a great Oregonian whose life centered on service in support of the religious values of justice, peace, equity, and the unity of all people. Through her interfaith commitments, she ensured that religious communities, along with other sectors of society, came together seeking common ground for dialogue, such a need today. This was clearly seen through her work with the Interreligious Network of Washington County and the Human Rights Council of Washington County. Her deep concern for the health and wellness of all people living on the economic margins led her to help found the Oregon Faith Roundtable Against Hunger. And her advocacy efforts and organizational affiliations were numerous, including the Coalition Against Hate Crimes, the Interfaith Advocacy Day, and the Save Darfur Coalition. She was a tireless advocate for justice who believed that all people deserve to be treated with dignity and respect. Emily believed that everyone in our state should have the opportunity to live lives full of possibility, no matter their country of origin, religious, cultural, or ethnic backgrounds, or socioeconomic status. While Emily is no longer physically with us, her spirit lives on throughout her family, friends, co-workers, and all of the people she touched through her all-too-short life. Emily embodied the best of her faith and the best of what it means to be an Oregonian. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. In yesterday's New York Times, columnist David Brooks offered advice on choosing a career. One line for me captured Emily perfectly.
Excuse me, sir. Could you identify yourself record?
Sure. I'm Daniel Isaac, rabbi of Congregation of Beishalom. One line in that article, for me, captured Emily perfectly. Brooks quoted novelist Frederick Buchner. Pick a vocation, he said, where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. Anyone who knew Emily would agree that that's exactly what she did. In nominating Emily to lead the Oregon Area Jewish Community Committee, the organization made a perfect choice, a place where her deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. When Emily died, I was on a short sabbatical, traveling with my wife in Myanmar. I therefore was not able to attend her funeral or the other rituals attended upon Jewish deaths, and therefore I appreciate this opportunity to share with you thoughts about the energy and enthusiasm of this special person. While away, I sent contact emails to my congregation describing our many experiences, the people, the cuisine, daily life, observations on politics and religion. And in my last travel report, I wrote about Emily, who was not a member of my congregation, not a social friend, but a consummate professional in our community. I titled it, Emily Gottfried, Indefatigable Passion for Interreligious, Interracial, and Interethnic Understanding. And I wrote, On the other side of the world, here in Myanmar, I received the shocking news of Emily's sudden passing. It's simply difficult to conceive, so full of energy, so engaged in life, so in love with music. Director of the Oregon Area Jewish Committee became the perfect platform for Emily's drive. She became the Jewish face for interreligious activity as our representative on the Portland Interfaith Council in supporting action on hunger relief, in participating in interfaith Thanksgiving services and creating dialogue groups between Jews and other religious, racial, and ethnic groups so that we could better appreciate each other's traditions, stories, and values. Emily was a delight to work with. She called on me to lead our annual interfaith Passover Seder together with her, to which she gathered Catholics, Mormons, Greek Orthodox, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, Native Americans, and all sorts of Protestants. I sat on the AJC board for a few years during her leadership. She got me involved in a Catholic-Jewish dialogue group, which has been meeting for over 15 years. Only recently, she invited me to offer the opening prayer at the OAJC dinner honoring Rob and Mara Schlachter. You didn't want to turn Emily down because invariably the task involved bringing people together to better understand one another, and who wouldn't want to be connected to that? So we will miss all the joy that Emily brought to the tasks she undertook and all the potential that remains to be done. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Sir?
My name is Wajdi Saeed. I'm the president and the co-founder of the Muslim Education Trust. I have known Emily Gottfried for over 15 years and applaud all her efforts to engage with the diverse communities in Portland, Oregon. Despite all the challenges that human family faces, Emily was always in the forefront of building bridges and cultivating relations with everyone around her. Emily has been a longtime friend for so many individuals I have known for the past 26 years, and her passion for interfaith work was reflected in so many relationships that she has developed. She built over the years. Emily was the coordinator of the human rights poster contest, which our students at the Oregon Islamic Academy have participated and won so many prizes because of her encouragement. Emily spearheaded this wonderful effort, which opened up many doors for our students to express themselves and communicate their own views of the world. It gave them a chance to express their faith and compassion for human rights in a visual manner that was very well received and appreciated by all judges. Despite some of our differences, these differences never hindered our love and respect for each other as individuals, working together for the betterment of our society. We always had respect for each other. I came today to testify Emily's accomplishment to fight hunger and human rights in the Portland metropolitan area. Our teachings, the Quran, teaches us invite of all for the to the way of your Lord with wisdom and beautiful preaching, and argue with people that are indifferent with you in the way that are best and most gracious, for the Lord knows what is best for all humans. Emily is a testimony of a great human being that we loved and respected in the Muslim American community. Emily has provided for us the best gift beside, you know, her engagement with us, that is her husband that works with us closely, Jeff Gottfried, worked closely with us, with the Muslim youth of the Muslim Education Trust in so many ways. Emily surely will be missed. Emily is a great leader that engaged people that differ with her as much as people that are in agreement with her. Thank you very much, Jan, for this opportunity.
Thank you so much for sharing that.
Good afternoon. I'm Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Task Force, and this is quite a bit different testimony than I'm used to giving before committees. I knew Emily through serving with her both on the steering committee for the Oregon Faith Roundtable Against Hunger and on the Oregon Food Bank Advocacy Committee. Emily deeply cared about all people, and my background being Episcopalian didn't really matter to her. She invited me to many Jewish festivals and events, and I enjoyed the interfaith collaboration and community very much. Emily cared especially about those who needed a hand up. she would draw on her principles to move us all to that higher calling of doing what is best for the community. And she encompassed many causes over the years. I remember she was always the first to open her home for retreats or long meetings to really sit down and discuss deeply issues that we had concern about. She wanted action, but she wanted it grounded in good thinking. And I think I'll remember Emily most for her can-do attitude. When she was the annual organizer of the OFRA Awards Breakfast, and when Emily's husband asked at her memorial service if we would all remember WWED, what would Emily do? I took that to heart, and I think it expresses Emily's legacy well. I keep her picture close to me in my office and often look at it to ponder on what I should do next. Thank you for this opportunity to honor Emily and her commitment and life.
Thank you very much for sharing. And
this is all of our witnesses?
Yes, it is. Again, thank you for sharing. And with that, I'll accept a motion.
Madam Chair, I move SCR 3A to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Hicks moves SCR 3A to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? If not, motion passes and SCR 3A is adopted, and Representative Greenlick will
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. Okay, with that, I want to open a work session, a public hearing, on House Bill 3390. Our first panel would be Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Steiner Hayward, Representative Vega Peterson, and Representative Dembro.
And members of the committee, House Bill 3390 requires paid sick leave be paid. There is a dash 2 amendment that replaces the original measure. The amendment requires covered employer to implement sick leave policy allowing eligible employer to accrue at least 56 hours of paid sick leave per year at rate of 1 hour per 30 hours worked. Eligible employee shall begin to earn and accrue paid sick leave on first day of employment with covered employer. Creates exceptions and does not apply to employer who has sick leave policy that A, provides eligible employees with paid sick leave benefits that equal or exceed the paid sick leave benefits required in this act. B, specifies that protections against retaliation specified in this act are applicable to the employee. Employer is not required to compensate employee for accrued unused sick time upon employee's termination, resignation, retirement, or other separation from employment. Specifies purposes for which leave may be taken. Specifies when employer may require advance written notice or medical verification. Specifies when employee can take leave without prior notice. Requires employer post summary of paid sick leave provisions. Makes denial of paid sick leave or discrimination against employee for inquiring about using sick leave an unlawful practice. Authorizes civil action. There was a fiscal statement issued on the original measure. We do not have a revenue or impact on the dash 2 amendment.
Senator Rosenbaum and Representative Vega Peterson will not be joining us at this moment. So, Thank Senator Rosenbaum.
I promise you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair,
members of the House Rules Committee. I am Senator Dianne Rosenbaum and very, very glad to join you today to talk about House Bill 3390 and about the need for Oregon to join many, many other jurisdictions in considering earned sick time for the people who need the help that this bill will provide. And I also want to thank you for taking time out of what I know is a very busy schedule to be able to hear this bill at this point in session. I know from chairing the Senate Rules Committee that things are really chaotic right now in your committee. And so being able to carve out time to consider this extremely important issue means a lot to the people who have been working very hard on this bill all session long. And even more than that, means a lot to all of the approximately 600,000 Oregonians who do not currently have paid sick time as part of the things that they can count on their job. I think if you've been following what's been going on in people's lives in this terrible economy, it doesn't take too much imagination to think about just how many Oregonians are faced with a really unfortunate choice on a regular basis, and that choice is to be able to stay home when they're sick, to be able to stay home with a child who's sick, or need to go to work and earn a paycheck and be at work when they really shouldn't be and when it's not in the benefit of the employee or their employer for them to be there. And just to give you an idea of the magnitude of this problem, there really are, and it may be hard for some of us to believe, almost 600,000 people who are employed and do not have even one paid sick day that they can take when they're sick or a family member like a child needs them. And perhaps even more shocking, about half of those 600,000 people don't have any paid time off whatsoever that they can take. So it's not an option for them to take a vacation day because they don't have paid vacation, they don't have paid sick time, they just need to be at work every day no matter what their circumstances. And I think that the bill that you're going to be hearing about from a number of people who've been working hard on this would really go a long way to, it's not going to totally solve that problem, but it would go a long way to making life more livable for people, acknowledging the fact that we do have people working at very low-wage jobs because overwhelmingly the people that we're talking about are not earning all that much money on the job. And yet, like everybody else, and perhaps even more than you and me, they're often living paycheck to paycheck. They're often single moms. They're often people where both family members are working, and there really is nobody to deal with those healthcare emergencies that strike all of us. I also want to talk a little bit about how this bill would fit with the long tradition of leadership in Oregon. You may or may not know that we actually had the very first parental leave laws in the country. We were the first state to actually adopt unpaid time off for people who have a seriously ill family member. And our law, which is now called the Oregon Family Leave Act, became the model for that very famous Family and Medical Leave Act, the federal law, which we just celebrated the anniversary of. So engaging on a discussion about providing a minimal number of paid sick days, earned sick days, for people that don't have them really builds on a tradition of strong bipartisan support for those other laws. Those didn't happen overnight, but they really did happen because of strong leadership like the leadership that I know the members of this committee represent, and bipartisan leadership too. And I think that's something that we'll be able to engage on with this discussion. So I think those are, as an introduction, some of the things I wanted to say. I think you're well aware that the City of Portland on March 13th did pass a local earned sick time ordinance that will take effect in January. By doing that, Portland joined Seattle and San Francisco and Washington, D.C., and now New York City, so that many local jurisdictions have acknowledged the need to have a law like this and make one that will work for their area. The state of Connecticut also has a law that's in effect, and I think what we're acknowledging today by holding a hearing on this bill is that we can come together and craft a law that works for everybody in Oregon. We think that it is in the interests of both the people who need this protection and their employers to be able to come to a resolution that works for the entire state. Obviously, cities have managed to do this effectively, but we think that it's just as fair for somebody in John Day or somebody in Eugene or somebody in Portland to be able to not have to face that choice of getting up in the morning,
being desperately ill or having a child that needs you and then having to go off to work and just deal with it. I don't think that's the kind of state that we are. I think that we will be able to find the sweet spot on this bill. And I, again, applaud you for beginning that discussion today and the leadership that you're showing. And I'll turn it over to my colleagues to add a little more about this proposal.
Thank you, Senator. Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And may I make a personal request? I have a visual thing that makes it really tough for me to look at. Thank you so much. I'm very grateful. And thank you all for hearing this bill. I'm really grateful. You know, I completely agree with everything that Senator Rosenbaum said, but I come to you in my advocacy for this issue.
Oh, Senator, could you identify?
Oh, I'm so sorry. I got distracted by the light issue.
The light.
Elizabeth
said that was our plan.
And you succeeded admirably, Madam Chair. Elizabeth Steiner, Hayward State Senator, District 17, Northwest Portland, Unincorporated, Multnomah, Washington County, and parts of Beaverton. And I'm coming to you not only as a strong legislative advocate for this, but also as a public health advocate. Most of you know that in my other life, I'm a family physician on faculty for Oregon Health and Science University. And as such, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this issue in terms of the public health implications. Senator Rosenbaum mentioned that there are 600,000 people in this state who don't have access to earned sick leave. Fewer than 1 in 5 food preparation and service workers. 20%, less than 20%. And those are the people who are serving us our food, who are preparing our food, who are working in close customer contact on a day-to-day basis. They're the ones who we really don't want to be coming to work sick, and yet they're the ones that are least likely to have access to earned sick time. This is a huge public health issue, and we know that there have been epidemics of Norwalk virus, that nasty gastroenteritis, hepatitis A, and all sorts of other things that relate to people coming to work when they're ill because they don't have paid time off for this. Without sick leave, people put off seeing a physician, and that leads to increased emergency room visits and increased healthcare costs. We know that earned sick days allow workers to take the time necessary to get appropriate preventive and early intervention care, and this greatly reduces the burden. In Oregon, we estimate that universal access to earned sick days would prevent about 34,000 emergency department visits per year among private sector workers and their families, which would result, we believe, in an estimated healthcare cost reduction of about $29 million per year. Non-trivial sum of money in my book. And finally, we also want to point out that when parents can't take time off to care for their sick children, children go to school sick. Parents don't have a choice, and their kids go to school sick. Now, first of all, it's very hard to learn when you're sick. And second of all, it's very easy to spread your germs to another kid, which only compounds the problem. Children get better faster when they're able to stay home and rest appropriately, get the appropriate TLC from their parents. Parents worry less when they're able to be home with their kids, and so their productivity at work is improved. Representative Vega Peterson, I know, is going to talk more about the economic issues that encourage us to move this bill forward. But without paid sick time, caring for a sick child or taking a child for appropriate preventive care is a really significant problem. It's just better for our kids in general. Finally, I mentioned that sick workers and parents of sick children are less productive. We know that workers who report to work when they're sick have significantly lower productivity. I've been wandering around the building myself today saying that I think I'm on the verge of getting a cold, and I know I'm slightly fuzzier. I've been washing my hands a lot and not shaking hands today to try to avoid the contagion problem, but I know I'm not at my best. A recent study by the Institute for Women's Policy Research found that in Oregon, the total cost to employers of this unproductive time in terms of wages and associated payroll taxes is $8.3 million per year. Frankly, I suspect that's an underestimate, although I can't do it. And this is a cost of illness that employers are already bearing. So if we can replace that cost with one that's more thoughtful and more appropriate and is done in the right ways, it's going to be better for everybody in the long term. And thank you so much for taking the time to hear this bill. We strongly believe this is in Oregon's best interest.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson, and I represent House District 47, which is the part of the city of Portland that's east of I-205. So my colleagues have done a great job giving you an idea of who's affected by the lack of paid sick leave. But I wanted to let you know that in Oregon, there are more than 145,000 workers of color who don't have a single hour of paid sick leave or earned sick leave from work to recover from their common illnesses. And this lack of earned sick leave disproportionately affects workers of color, as 63% of Latinos and 45% of African American workers in the private sector don't have access to this basic labor standard. For Oregon, there are 22% of children live in households headed by a single mother. These mothers, and thus their families, are more likely to live in poverty. 44% of all single mothers in our state live in poverty. However, this jumps to an overwhelming 60% of Latino and African American mothers who are living in poverty. When there's only one breadwinner in a family, and that person is unable to take time off from work to care for themselves or their family as well, they have to choose between staying with their staying home with their child or facing significant financial crisis. Not having earned sick time doesn't just hurt workers, it also has consequences for Oregon's businesses. Small businesses in Oregon, and we are a state made up of small businesses, run on the dedication and support of their loyal and hardworking staff. When employees have access to earned sick time, it reduces the harmful impact on workplace productivity, employee turnover, and healthcare costs. Something that will save businesses time and money and allows them to keep their staff. My husband, Aaron, is a co-owner of a small business in Gladstone, Oregon, and he and his business partner have always offered paid sick leave to their employees. They consider it a requirement, not just because it's the right thing to do, but also as a way to be a viable employee in a highly competitive industry. For them, offering paid sick leave is the key to recruiting the best employees for their company. And this can be the same for other businesses in Oregon. We want Oregon businesses to be able to recruit and keep their valued employees. Allowing workers to earn paid sick time provides those workers with job security, which in turn improves employee retention. Research suggests that workers who have access to earned sick time are less likely to leave their jobs than workers who do not. This reduces turnover and its associated costs to businesses. House Bill 3390 creates a floor labor standard for all businesses so that we can level the playing field for businesses in Oregon that are doing the right thing. I urge your support of this bill, and thanks again for having this hearing.
Thank you so much. Any questions for this panel or comments? Representative Denver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senators, and Representative Vega Peterson for coming and bringing this bill. This is a bill that's very important to me. I'm very proud that my own city has instituted an ordinance along these lines. I suspect that we're going to see efforts in other cities, I believe we already are, try to do something comparable to deal with the issues that you've raised, the public health issue, the issue of the particular burden on low-income families. And at the at the same time, I think we all believe that the ultimate goal would be to have a single standard statewide, as was mentioned. During the Portland hearings, there was a lot of concern raised by the business community about having multiple standards in different cities. And I believe that the Dash 2 or Dash 3 amendments, whatever we're dealing with now, are an effort to take the original bill and to make it be something that can have a future statewide. And so, I really, I commend you for that. I guess, I would ask, do you foresee outreach being made to the business community, to other advocacy groups, to move this along with? What is it that you have in mind?
Well, I'll answer that if that's okay. Senator Diane Rosenbaum, for the record. And I want to thank Representative Dembro for the incredible leadership that he's shown on this issue. But I think it's a great point, because I think the Portland Ordinance was presented and then significantly modified as a result of a formalizing of a discussion with business groups and other concerned people in Portland. And it already discussions have taken place. I know I've, you know, as busy as I am, I've participated in some discussions with the Restaurant Association and the Grocers Association about what kinds of things would make this the most workable in their particular industries. So I have no doubt that that kind of conversation can take place. It's not as if everybody is always going to agree on everything about this, but hopefully there is a place to come together, because obviously, I think particularly as Senator Steinmeier Hayward talked about, food service businesses do not want to be in the business of serving the flu. They want to be in the business of serving good food with good service. And so I'm confident that we can find a version of this that will work for the state of Oregon.
Any other comment? Representative Hovey.
Thank you. Curious, because I've heard some discussions that this may be coming to Eugene as well, which is a district that I serve, and I'm looking forward to that conversation. I think it's an idea that is overdue, but I'm curious what kind of feedback, if it's too early to tell in Portland, what kind of feedback you've had on from businesses and from, you know, people in Portland about their new ordinance.
I'm not sure I'm in the best position to answer that. I think you may be hearing from other witnesses that can talk about that. That's a law that won't take effect until next January.
Mm-hmm.
But there were packed hearing rooms, and I think the private discussions of their task force were really well attended and well engaged. And, you know, they're obviously, as Representative Vega Peterson said, we are a small business state, so there are numerous small business associations, some of whom were already providing earned sick time for their employees, some that were not. So.
Okay, other questions or comments? No, thank you very much for sharing. And as I call up the next panel, Andrea Paluzzo, Melissa Erlbaum, and Michael Summers, the piece of machinery that we have up here will let you know when 3 minutes are up. We would ask, because we have two hearings with a lot of people that are here, that we keep comments focused, and again, we'll let you know when 3 minutes are up, so 2 to 3 minutes would be fantastic.
Yes. Hi, my name is Andrea Paluzzo. I'm the Executive Director of Family Forward Oregon and the Chairperson for the Everybody Benefits Coalition for Paid Sick Time. I'm going to keep my comments really short. I will hand over a written testimony from me that goes much more into detail. I'm absolutely available if folks have any additional questions beyond this hearing. I think you've heard a lot already about the benefits and the need for a law like this. I really wanted to talk a little bit more about the process that got us here and some specific components in the Dash 2s, and then I'll turn over my time to the rest of our panel. So the process that did get us here today was a long and inclusive one. We did begin conversations about a paid sick time law in Oregon over 3 years ago with some of the legislators that you heard from. And some of you. Over the last 18 months and through our work as a large and growing coalition to pass an ordinance in Portland, we've had tens of thousands of conversations with citizens, business owners, affected workers, advocates, parents, teachers, and many others. We've engaged in a lot of policy discussions, forums, and town halls, and I was fortunate to participate in the task force in Portland that made amendments to the bill that was passed there. So in practice, the House Bill 3390 would require employers that have six or more employees to let their employees earn an hour of sick time for every 30 hours they work, up to 56 hours a year. Employers would be encouraged to do better than that standard, but most employees that work for companies of that size would at least be guaranteed that number of hours. The Dash 2 amendments that are before you today reflect some of the changes that arose largely out of the task force process in Portland and then some other conversations with stakeholders during this session. They provide some clarity to employers. We submitted a memo to, I believe, each of you detailing the changes that those amendments include. But specifically, they clarify the ways in which an employer can investigate abuses. The way they clarify language around finding replacement employees, around the employee needing to work for an employer for 90 days before they're eligible for time, around record-keeping requirements. But most importantly, I think, to employers, they clarify very clearly that if you already offer offer paid time off of any kind that an employee can use for the purposes of sick time that equal the provisions in this law, that you don't have to do anything different about what you're doing. I think that's a really important thing. So we're here, we're supportive, we're looking for ways to provide information, happy to answer any questions, and we'll continue to work with our coalition to support your efforts on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, and I think you're a great example. If you have written testimony, know that that's part of the record, and we have that. And so if you can just speak to, sort of give us your personal story, that would be fantastic. We will read what's on the record. So yourself.
Sure. My name is Melissa Albaum. I'm a resident of West Lynn, and I'm also the executive director for Clackamas Women's Services. And I'm here to support House Bill 3390-2 because it really affects how domestic violent survivors, survivors of sexual assault and stalking, can access safety and resources. What we know is that over 37% of Oregon women have reported they've experienced domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking in their lifetime. And sadly, we know that since 2009, we've lost over 150 lives in the state of Oregon due to domestic violence. That's men, women, and children. We know that victims are at the most significant risk of being harmed during the separation period, and yet that's the time in which they need to access really critical safety resources to be able to leave a violent situation. We have reports that 96% of domestic violence survivors share that their ability to be productive and perform job duties is impacted by the violence they're experiencing, and 69% were employed at the time they were victims. So what this bill would do would allow victims, as you may know or may not know, right now if a victim needs to get a protection order, they have to be in the courthouse at 9:45 in the morning, complete the paperwork, and then return again at 2 for their hearing. That's in our county. Many counties are similar. So you can understand and see why I feel like this would be really critically important. It's just simply unacceptable that we would have victims returning to violent homes because of economic security, because they're not able to keep their job or be paid when they're out getting this critical resource. So thank you for hearing the testimony and all the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much, sir.
Yes, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Sumner. I'm the owner of Case Automotive in Woodburn, Oregon. I commute daily from St. Helens, where I have my home, to Woodburn, but I am a property owner as well in Woodburn. So you can say that I'm a constituent of several districts. I'm also on the executive team for Main Street Alliance here in Oregon. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 3390. I've been in the automotive industry for 25 years, and 7 years ago I bought a shop in Woodburn, Case Automotive. I bought the property from the former employer in Woodburn, and when I was an employee there, he would supply this time, paid time off for us for sick leave as well as vacation, and this is something that I had continued as an employer to my employees as well, because I believe it was a very important aspect to carry on and have my employees partake in. It pays off for me in several ways. First, I don't get people coming in to work sick and getting others infected is a big thing to me, because I one employee down, it's a large part of my workforce. I only have 5 employees total, so if I have 2 down, that really, really kills my business. And it also keeps them motivated. They're very loyal. As an example, I had an accident last year back in July where I had a head-on collision on my motorcycle. And one of my employees who had worked for me for 5 years, who had used this sick time off, and she did use it with pneumonia that she had had, came back out of retirement to help run the business again while I was down. And so the loyalty was went on for a long time, well after her employment at my shop. So having healthy employees that can do their best at my place of business, as well as the level of loyalty, and it's hard to find good employees these days. So I believe in HB 3390 as being an integral part of doing business, and I've been doing it for years.
Thank you so much. Okay, next panel, Susan Lund, Ty Schwefferman, and Lee Mercer.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
While they're coming up, I'd like to make a comment about the materials that I've been reviewing. while we've been listening. This bill doesn't, the materials I have don't actually cut this direction, but one of the things I think about when I look at a bill like this is the effect on our traded sector economy. Because one of the arguments that might be made is that it is the effect on traded sector economy. The reality of this bill, as you look at the occupational categories, the fact that mostly it's poor, lower income people who are affected by this, suggests that we're talking mostly about the service economy that's local, and therefore this bill would have little or no effect on our competitiveness in the world. We're talking about things that happen inside Oregon and that are going to continue to happen inside Oregon whether we pass this bill or not.
Okay, any other comments before the next panel? Okay, why don't you start?
Okay. Hi, my name is Ty Schwafferman. I'm Vice Chair and members of the House Rules Committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify in front of you today. I'm testifying on behalf of the Urban League of Portland to support HB 3390 with the -2 amendments. Again, I'm here representing the Urban League, but also the Paid Sick Time Coalition. You know, we get calls all the time at the Urban League of Portland. We receive calls from our community members. We primarily serve African Americans throughout the community, and especially folks who are both employed, looking for employment, and also seniors and the elderly. One thing that we hear a lot is that our community is facing discrimination and victimization within the workplace. One case in particular that came up is when a woman called and she wasn't really welcome in her workplace. So she did everything she could to really stay. She was determined. She was focused to stay. And, you know, she couldn't do anything really to appease her supervisor. And one day when she became ill, she had to seek emergency care and was out for almost 2 days. What happened was she was written up. Eventually, she was dismissed for the missing those days. And just within our community, the average African-American worker searches for nearly 10 months to find a new job once they've been laid off. The threat of job loss for, you know, taking an unsanctioned sick day is a very real issue in our community. She actually ended up winning her case with Boley, with Boley's help, and they really kind of recognized her. So we urge your support for the passage of HB 3390 and the -2 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. No, you go ahead.
Okay. So, Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Lee Mercer, and I'm a small business owner and a member of the executive team of Main Street Alliance of Oregon. We have about 1,200 businesses around the state on our roster, and Main Street Alliance is in support of HB 3390-2. I've also submitted a letter of support from 27 small business owners statewide with a sampling of their comments in support of paid sick leave. Last year, I surveyed over 700 businesses around the state of Oregon on various issues. One of the questions I asked last spring was, do you agree or disagree with the value statement? Small businesses care more about their workers than big chains do. Small business owners see their workers as family and want to treat them right, including offering benefits like health care and paid time off. Of 350 business owners surveyed, 79% agreed with this view of small business. This indicated to us that a strong majority of small businesses want to do the right things for their employees in terms of benefits. Then last fall, we added a question to the survey. Do you currently offer earned sick leave or other paid time off for your employees? Fully 80% of those surveyed, and this was throughout rural Oregon, no Portland in the sampling, said they did not give paid sick leave. But to the question, would you support a sick leave standard for all employers, 46% would support a standard, 41% would oppose, the balance were undecided. So even in rural Oregon, often characterized as more conservative than the Portland metro area, more small business owners support the idea of a common standard than oppose it. But for small business owners, it's the bottom line that you have to get to in terms of the cost of a new benefit. Let's look at some of the costs of illness in the workplace. One of costs, of course, is each business owner's share of $160 billion lost nationally to productivity due to workplace illness. Closer to home are the tens of thousands of dollars spent by businesses in rehiring and retraining employees due to employee turnover. But what are the actual costs of providing the benefit itself? According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the cost of providing paid sick leave in the Pacific West region is 0.9% of total compensation. If you give benefits all the time and replacement workers all the time, that goes up to about 1.9%. I was in the movie theater business for 20 years in California, Nevada, owned and managed a number of theaters, and some of them really struggled, but 0.9% of payroll to 1.9% would have never tipped over a business that I was running, even the most struggling businesses. Now, a boarding and grooming kennel my wife and I own and operate offers paid time off, health insurance, and a retirement plan for 30 employees. These benefits have attracted and retained a caring, motivated, and productive team who have helped grow our business, even through the recent recession, into a sustainable and profitable enterprise. Please vote yes on HB 3390-2 to create a statewide sick leave standard in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mercer.
Hello, my name is Susan Lund. I'm Vice Chair and members of the House Committee of Rules. Thank you for this opportunity to share my views on HB 3390-2. I have worked for the same grocery store for 15 years, and while I have some paid sick hours, I can't actually use them until the third day that I'm sick. On top of that, I had to bring a doctor's note or else I would get in big trouble. I can't afford to lose 2 days' pay, and I certainly can't afford to go to the doctor on top of that. As a result, I do go to work sick all the time. When I absolutely can't get to work because I'm so sick and I stayed home without pay, I had to decide which bills wouldn't get paid. I do my best to keep it from affecting my children, but I don't always succeed. Even though I had worked for the same employer for 15 years, I worried about being fired if I was sick. As a mother, I've had to stay home sick occasionally, not only for my own sickness, but also for my children's. In addition, this past year, my son was being bullied, and I had to take time off of work in order to stay home with him and keep him safe. As a result, I took what was considered to be too many unpaid sick days. I was written up and told that I'm on a slippery slope and I need to be careful. This is devastating to me. I need my job and I couldn't afford to get fired or quit. Paid sick days would make a big difference to me and so many people like me. I wouldn't have to go to work sick. I wouldn't have to worry about paying my bills, and I could address my son's being bullied at school without being scared of losing my job. I hope you will pass this law. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, next, any questions from committee, comments? Okay, next panel, Carl Harbaugh, Tom Simpson, and Jan Meekums.
My name is Carl Harbaugh. I own a company here in Salem called Southtown Glass, and I have somewhere around 37 employees. Some of them are union and some of them are non-union. I've been here 30 plus years. And I believe I don't really have a policy for sick pay, but I'm very tolerant of it. And if I find one of my employees working for me that is not in good shape or is not doing well, I send them home. And we give them vacation time and holiday pay. And some people are on salaries and some people aren't on salaries. It's a mixed bag of different things, and I've negotiated with different employees a different rate for different things and duties that they do. This would extremely complicate what it is I do. I treat my people fair, but to try to renegotiate my wage packages with each of my salary people, and then not to mention my union people, I don't believe there's anything in there, a clause about sick pay. They have a quantity of days and that they accumulate, and they get paid for it with their wages, and so it's accumulated. So they just when they don't work, they pull out of that fund. So it's a little bit different operation than what the norm is. And so how is that going to be affected by this law? And what are you going to do to accommodate that with that particular? And we deal with Davis-Bacon Acts. Now I just heard that we've got to go to Portland. We do a lot of work in Portland, and I bid jobs that are out next year, and now I'm going to have some expense there because they do work a lot in the Portland area, and now here's an added cost that I have that I haven't anticipated. So we build schools and we do all kinds of things. I think I did probably 20 schools in the last 3 or 4 years that we put glass in, and I think we're good for the community, do a good job. And that's going to increase our rates, so it's going to increase your cost of building. It's going to increase your products. I mean, the bottom line is us subcontractors and employers are going to have to pay the bill to do this. And a lot of us have already got their numbers locked in. And there's nothing we can do about it because we have to bid work so far out there. And I'm right on the cusp of even making a living right now. I mean, it's so competitive out there, we can barely be able to get work, and now this gets thrown on top of it. It's gonna break the back of a lot of contractors, subcontractors, and a lot of businesses. And I urge you strongly to try to find an alternative. I like the idea of having sick pay, and I give it to my employees where I can. But maybe if you just set up some rules and said, let's try to work on a plan, or let's see what happens in Portland. Let's not just dump this thing on us. We already got Obamacare. So please be patient with us and help us out.
Thank you. Sir.
My name is Tom Simpson, Vice Chair Hoyle, members of the committee. I work at a standard insurance company in Portland, Oregon. We have 3,000 employees, most of which are based in Portland. You would think maybe that our benefits package meets or exceeds this measure, and they do. However, we would normally walk away and just play neutral on this bill, but there's some parts of it that concern us. Not the least of which is we would like to see organizations and companies that have benefits that exceed this to be excluded. However, the section 2 dash or subsection 4 talks about paid sick time off. Our benefits are paid time off. And you well know, being down here in Salem, that sometimes the change of a couple of words makes all the difference in the world. So we would like to see companies that use paid time off as a pool to have that meet or exceed this have the exclusion for those who have paid time off or paid sick time off. In addition, the way we provide notice to our employees is during open enrollment, and we provide it electronically. This bill says you need to put a piece of paper up on a wall. Our method is much more effective at getting the right information to our employees at the right time, but we're going to have to do that in addition to what we do. It would be nice to have an option. So it's not just mandate that we do a particular way that the bill says, but to say, get this information in the employee's hands the way you get other information to your employee's hands. And finally, in Section 6, Subsection 2, it talks about that the employer having to pay for a doctor's note, and that this is perhaps in alignment with other leaves. It is in alignment with child sick leave laws, but there are other leaves in Oregon that this does not align to. And it seems as though this is one area where this bill may be out of sync with all the other leaves that we have in Oregon. It would be nice for this committee or maybe some other group to spend some time aligning with all of the leaves to at least reduce the administrative burden of those companies that are trying to do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Meekins.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hoyle and members of the committee. My name is Jan Meekums. I'm the State Director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We are celebrating our 70th anniversary this year. We have 7,500 small business members in the state of Oregon. Our typical member has less than 10 employees. We did ballot the paid sick leave question last year, and 87% of our members said that they were opposed to a mandated paid sick leave. And I believe many of those members did offer a paid sick leave. The issue we have is that it's mandated. We have a lot of small members. We are a small business state. We have some, according to the latest statistics, that there are about 77,000 small businesses that employ have 20 or less employees. And together they employ about 310 workers. They would be tremendously impacted by this bill. In April, you have before you written testimony, and I'd like to just bring up some salient points. NFIB did do two research projects on paid sick leave. One was for the state of Colorado, and they found, and their research indicated that the state of Colorado would lose about 14,000 jobs between 2012 and 2016. We also did one for the state of Massachusetts, and it was discovered, their research showed that about 16,000 jobs would be lost in Massachusetts between 2012 and 2016 if they enacted their paid sick leave. And it's small firms that would bear two-thirds of those losses. They also estimated there'd be $8.4 billion lost in real output, and that two-thirds, that more than half of that loss would also be borne by small businesses. In March of 2013, U.S. News and World Report, Connecticut did pass a paid sick leave, and they worked on it from about 2007, I think it passed in 2012. They took 86 businesses, and they, after the fact, to see what kind of effect it had by survey. And what they reported is that nearly 30% of the lowest paid employees reported layoffs or reduction in hours. Well, this is San Francisco, following San Francisco's passage of sick leave. And regarding Connecticut, and the 86 businesses affected by the law found that they had taken various steps besides layoffs to adapt to costs. 31 of these companies had scaled back on employee benefits or reduced paid leave to account for the cost of the new law. 12 had cut back employee hours, and another 6 reduced employee wages. And 38 businesses said they were likely to hire fewer people in the future due to the paid sick leave law. And 35 employers planned to offer fewer raises, and 32 planned to raise prices on their products. So this is some of the effects that are seen. I'd just like to make two points. Two states, one Florida, legislators recently approved a ban on mandatory paid sick leave that is before the governor for signature. And Milwaukee passed a measure in 2008, and 4 years later, they overturned it by state legislators who cited the need to help businesses stay competitive. And as we know, small businesses are trying to recover from a long.
We appreciate it. Thank you. Questions from committee? Representative Denbrock.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, first, I just do want to say, Ms. Meekums, that the study that you referenced from Connecticut has, I believe, been discredited. That it was a study that was, the outreach was to businesses that had a problem with, the sick leave policy. And I'd be happy to share with the committee the statements around that. My understanding is that San Francisco has not had a negative impact since its ordinance was put into place. That in fact there was, although there were some speculations about negative effects, in fact they haven't been borne out at all to date. I would quibble with that. I do have a question for the two gentlemen on the panel. It sounds as if you're not opposed to sick leave in concept, but there are some details that you think need to be worked out with this bill, and you know, so that it would not interfere with the practice in your businesses.
Well, we need to be able to plan for things, and if you just implement this like you're talking about, it takes over a year sometimes for us to go through contracts, and I mean, and all the legal ramifications with my contracts and everything that's going on. I don't know, does Boley have sick pay involved in it? I don't believe it says sick pay. So a lot of our work is involved with Boley. Maybe you should start with your own laws. The other thing is, too, is I think you need to think outside the box here a little bit, because you guys and most of what you guys are involved with is not for profit. We're for profit. We have to make money to keep our people employed. So we can pay them so they can get sick pay or whatever they have to do. And you're going to upset that apple cart hugely. It's going to devastate us, and it's not a good time to do that.
Vice Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, Representative Dembro, I've said we tried to stay neutral on this bill. However, our paid time off meets or exceeds this bill. So are we in favor of sick leave or providing to our employees? We already do that. However, this is adding additional administrative burden because we're having to do additional work because this bill is going to affect us, and that's unfortunate. I mean, for companies that are actually doing the right thing, it seems awful that the bill would be layered upon us to do additional work when we're already actually meeting or exceeding what the intent of the bill is.
Okay, thank you. If I could just follow up, but you know, as one of the sponsors of the bill, if there are ways to improve this bill, I think we would be open to those conversations and to make it so that it accords with, you know, the practices of as many businesses as possible.
I think that this is going to be a lot of issues that you don't really realize. The more I think about it, the more I see. And conflict of laws. You know, we've got a contract to do a certain thing for a certain price for employees. Now it's going to change. What do you do?
Any other comments or questions? And I want to thank this panel, and I would like to point out, Mr. Harbaugh, and I appreciate you taking time and running your business to come up and to testify on a matter of importance. I would also like to point out that we're a citizens' legislature, and most of us come from small business, worked in small business, have businesses, and the majority of legislators here do not come from a nonprofit background. So I appreciate what you're saying. I think the intent of leadership is to work in the interim, to have a work group so that we can discuss this issue and make sure that if we move forward with something, we do it in a way that supports workers, supports business, and is best for the state of Oregon. So again, thank you so much for bringing up some issues that may be unintended consequences, and it's certainly something we'll look into.
Thank you for listening.
Okay, next panel, Ian Tolson, J.L. Wilson, and John Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing Associated Oregon Industry. It's our position that paid sick leave would be a mistake, and I think it's, I'll just use our own family companies to illustrate the challenges associated with something like 3390. As Representative Hicks well knows, our family companies are in Josephine County. We employ between 15 and 19 full-time employees. We're a meaningful employer down near Grants Pass. Here's the reality of the marketplace. We're in tiny Josephine County. We're competing with about two dozen other companies, most of which are headquartered out of state in big corporate high rises somewhere else. Their product is in Oregon. We're having to compete with them. 3390 is essentially a 3% payroll tax because you're talking about an extra hour of paid leave for every 30 work. That's something that we would have to absorb that most of our competitors would not. So there's a competitive issue there that I think needs to be paid attention to, especially for small business. One thing that you should understand is we've been in business for 56 years. Our employment policies have been fashioned over that time. We know how to manage our employees through these types of situations. And I would say sick leave is a delicate situation because time offered is time taken. And so our policy like the gentleman before us at South Town Glass, we don't have a paid sick leave policy. We have 2 weeks of vacation, and then we do. It's not to say we don't give paid time off. If people are sick, we absolutely do. But the fact that we don't have a paid leave policy really enhances communication. People come to my father, they talk about it, and if they're sick, they get the day off or get several days off, and they're paid for it. It's not to say we don't offer paid sick leave. We just don't have the policy because we believe in the communication. Now, what would happen if we had 56 hours of paid sick leave overlaid on top of our policies? We're one of 50,000 employers in this state that has over six employees, which this bill contemplates. There's going to be some give. The 2 weeks of vacation is not going to be 2 weeks of vacation. We might switch to a PTO. We might have to diminish our own investment in our companies and diminish our own competitiveness to pay this benefit. But either way, it's not a desirable outcome either for us as the employer or our employees, because I guarantee their benefits won't look the same. And I don't think employees win in that situation. So that's a nutshell of our concerns over the measure. We don't support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Sir.
My name is John Miller. I live here in Kaiser. I have a business in Salem. I employ about 350 people. Some of them have paid time off. Some of them don't. One of the things that I agree with what JL said, time offered is time taken. We don't really care how you use your time. If you want to use it being sick, be sick. If you want to use it going on vacation, go on vacation. I find it very intrusive for an employer to be asking employees how you're using your time. And I find that very invasive. I'm also the current president of the Salem Chamber of Commerce, and I can absolutely guarantee you that if I was to poll our, I've talked to several of them, they find this whole idea to be a waiting disaster. Being president of the chamber, I go to a lot of meetings where legislators come and talk to us. It's been stated here that Oregon is a small business state, and legislators always, almost always, say the same thing, that, man, small business is awfully important to us. But every 2 years, I'm down here fighting something like this that makes it harder to be in small business. And When the gentleman made the statement that, oh, it's just 0.9%, that's not going to sink anybody, well, actually, this isn't 0.9%. It's 3.3%. And 0.9% compounded year after year after year with another idea like this that makes it harder to be in business will sink somebody. And so I would ask you to reconsider this. I think that employers as a whole care about their employees and really try to do the right thing with them. And employees have the ability to advocate for their own benefits and move themselves up the ladder, as is the case in my company, where an employee may start out without this benefit, but as they advance up the company, they earn the benefit.
Thank you.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, my name is Ian Tollison, and I represent Oregon Farm Bureau. I just wanted to talk about the agricultural implications a bill like this would have to our farms here in Oregon. There's a lot of crops that Oregon's farms harvest. Many of those are labor-intensive crops, such as nuts and fruits and vegetables. And a lot of those crops, they have a pretty strict timeline for harvest. So, for example, strawberries, you don't want to leave them in the field for any great length of time. It is very important for our farmers to be able to get all hands on deck when it's time to harvest. A bill like this gives us concern because we want to be able to have those people there at the ready and ready to go. And many of these farms, they're actually operating on loans, on operation loans. The farmer doesn't get their money for their harvest until months down the road. So they have tight margins, little profits. And, our farmers work in the fields with the workers day in and day out. I think they have a great pulse on what their employees need. This mandate, I don't believe, fits a farming model, and of course, many farmers are small businesses, and they need to be able to operate on profits to be able to keep produce going to the markets, going to the food, the farm stands, and that will definitely have a direct impact. So we oppose the bill. Thank you for hearing from me today.
Thank you. Okay, and the last two people on. So, any questions from the committee or comments?
Sure.
Yes.
Just one. I can appreciate your comments. I'm kind of curious though how, especially in the agriculture and the gentleman before in the construction industry, if people don't have the ability to take off work when they're sick, they're coming to work sick. It seems like that would be a threat, not to your productivity, one, and also in some industries a threat to safety as well, if people are compelled to come to work because they can't afford not to go to work. I'm just, and so at some point it seems like there should be a I don't know if anybody's done, thought through what is it actually costing me in productivity, what is it costing me in other factors by indirectly compelling people to come to work sick. I mean, I just want to know if you have a comment about that.
I can just, when I, said that my folks, they can use their time the way they want, I can just about guarantee you that one of my employees would rather come to work sick than use one of the days that they could be using sitting on the beach. And that's fine. I mean, if they're too sick, then we're not going to allow that to happen. But I just don't understand why you feel it's your purview to deal with this as opposed to letting the individual take care of themselves. They really do have the capacity. I was talking to a wine grower the other day. He was talking about how the last time there was immigration reform, because they're in favor of immigration reform, because it's going to make it easier to employ people. He said the last time it happened, within a few months, all their existing employees were gone. And it's because, now that they have the capacity to, they all got better jobs. Well, people have the ability to do that all the time, and that's the way, in my mind, a free enterprise system should work. Let them pursue their own best interests.
And Chair Hoyle, if I may, Representative Pulvey, there are definitely health standards on the farm. We don't want people picking any type of produce that may be sick. But I think there's certainly a level there where it's up to the employee to gauge, what their capacity is to do. There's plenty of opportunities on a farm to go elsewhere that they don't have direct contact with the products that they're picking or harvesting. If you have the ability to come to work, you want to work, there's something you can be doing to keep those health standards intact. But the mandate, I think I would go back to what I've heard, time taken or time offered is time taken. Being able to put those kind of issues at the farm, we're just not anxious to see that happen.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments?
I'll just make a quick comment, and that's, just to remind you that the intent of the bill is to exempt businesses that are giving equal to or better paid time off than is required in the bill, whatever you call it. We want to make this work for businesses. Thank you.
Next, last two people for this panel, Marsh Kelly and Bob Russell. And that's it.
Chair Hoyle and members of the committee, my name is Marsha Kelly and I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women. We have about 2,000 members in Oregon, both in branches and members at large. We've been advocating for issues for women, workplace issues, since our founding in 1881. And we are members of the National Coalition on Paid Sick Days. We think of this bill not only as a workplace bill, but a public health bill. As you've been just discussing, people coming to work sick, handling food, handling produce, infecting their other workers can create public health hazards. And so we'd like to take that into consideration, as well as having good family policies so that people can take care of their families at the same time as they can work to support their families. I will leave it at that because you've heard lots of testimony today. Again, AUW firmly supports paid work days. It's going to be one of our public policy emphasis next year as well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Association, and it looks like I'm bringing up the caboose today, which is kind of a weird thing for a trucker to say.
Say it next to a transit person.
Oregon's trucking industry transports about 80% of the total freight in the state. It's your clothing, it's your furniture, it's your groceries, and it's the products that our companies manufacture getting them to market. When we have members that have one truck, and we have some of the largest transportation companies in the world that belong to the Oregon Trucking Associations, this would impact small members and large members as well, some with labor contracts and some without. As is often the case with these kinds of legislation, the devil's in the details. And there are some details that are very concerning to my members. And I'm very glad to hear that the intent is to have a work group during the interim. And I would certainly volunteer to participate and express the concerns about the details in the Dash 2 amendments. But you've heard lots of testimony today. You've got another bill to hear and lots of people in the back of the room. So I will close with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions, comments? Okay, thank you very much. And with that, I'll close public hearing on House Bill 3390 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3536. And we'll call up for the first panel Representative Huffman and Matt Cyrus.
And members of the committee, House Bill 3536 modifies alternatives for establishing small-scale recreation community using transferable development opportunities from Atollius Resort sites. Directs Water Resources Department to periodically review program for Deschutes Basin groundwater study area and report to Legislative Assembly every 5 years.
Greetings, Madam Chair,
Representative.
Committee. Thanks for having us. I'm John Huffman, State Representative for House District 59, which includes Sisters in the Greater Sisters area of Northern Deschutes County. And I think we just handed out House Bill 3536 has an amendment that was just done in conjunction with Water Resources. Crafting of the bill on the water rights and stuff was not exact, and so we worked with Brenda Bateman from the department to have that amendment. So that's what's being handed out now. House Bill 3536 may appear, and I've heard it said that it's a end of session, end run, last minute kind of a bill. It's really been a much longer process than that. I was working with Matt on a predecessor bill in the 2009 session. It got set back because of the Metolius Basin legislation. Out of the Metolius Basin legislation in 2009, Richard Whitman developed, with Representative Clem, developed the TDOs, or Transfer Development Opportunities, which we're actually dealing with today. Then in 2011, I came in and we had another bill, working with Matt Cyrus on that bill. And in 2011, you'll probably recall that we had the Sylvie's Valley, Scott Campbell bill. Representative Clem, the governor's office, Richard Whitman decided that would be the big bill land use wise that moves forward. So here we are. I started last September, met in the Dalles with Richard Whitman, and went over two bills that I've had this session, one a Young Life bill and then the Cyrus bill, and we started work on both of those to be ready for this session. When I came into the session, we dropped a bill, and as I continued working with Senator Betsy Johnson, Richard Whitman, Representative Clem on what's the best approach, can we elevate the Cyrus bill this session, and Representative Clem had the idea of, oh wait, We've got these transfer development opportunity, the development credits out in Metolius Basin. Let's start pursuing how we might be able to fit the Cyrus bill into those TDOs. And so that's the process we began early February. Now, to kind of give you a synopsis of this session, we started out with House Bill 2749. I apologize. Too many numbers to keep track of. And this is what looks odd, but it's totally explainable. 2741 went through the process of back and forth amending. We went to the Land Use Committee, ended up getting a work session on the final day that House rules would allow a bill to move out of its chamber. Representative Clem had House Bill 2200 sitting there waiting for this bill to put it into to move to rules, knowing that we weren't going to meet the timeline. We got the bill to rules, and I directed LC to move 27 whatever into 2200. Harrison Conley took 4 days vacation that week. When he came back, he forgot about it. I contacted him the next week. I said, where's our bill? Isn't 2200 done yet? All in an effort to give everybody plenty of time to review what we were doing. Nothing was hidden. The next week, the speaker comes to me and says, we've got a relating clause. I'm nervous about 2200 and the relating clause. Do you have a priority bill? Can you drop a priority bill and move 2200 into that? Here we are today, House Bill 3536. So it may look screwy, but for those of you in the legislature, you can fully understand that things like this happen. And here we are 6 months down the road, 5 months down the road, 4.5 years down the road, and here we are. I'm going to turn the time over to Matt Cyrus to explain more about 3536, but I just wanted to go to the record. We have been working this week and continue to commit to work with the county, Deschutes County, Water Resources Department, DLCD, ODFW, and any other agency that has concerns about the way the bill is currently written. We are committed to working with them to resolve, just as we have done with the Dash 1 amendments on the water rights. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Cyrus.
Hey, Vice Chair Garrett and members of the committee. I've got a couple of exhibits if you're interested in me showing them for you. Okay. While he sets those out, I'll go ahead and get started quickly.
Identify for the record.
Oh, for the record, please. Could you identify
yourself? Matt Cyrus, Sisters, Oregon, here supporting the bill. The background, a little quick background on this, is that our family acquired a platted subdivision about 1988 and have been working since that time to develop it. We went through the planning process, the county process back then. We got approval to move forward with the golf course, residential lots. At the time, the county had not adopted its resort rules. And so we started through the process. At their recommendation, they said, do it in phases, get approval for the golf course, do a cluster development, build the amenities, and then come back and convert to resort. Over the last 25 years, resort rules have been a moving target, and things have changed quite a bit. However, in the meantime, what we have done was pretty much cutting edge for the development industry. We were the first development in the area to adopt the FireWise standards before there ever were standards. With our fire background, we did fuels reduction, we put in hydrants, we put in wide streets. In short, we made the property, or we made the development fire resistant. The development we have with the 18-hole golf course, we currently have roughly 50 employees. We contribute locally to the Sisters community. From a tourism standpoint, we bring in $15 to $25 million annually to the community in economic development revenue, people coming to golf. The reason we're here is because even though our property has a resort overlay, is zoned, much of it's zoned for rural residential, with some additional mixed zone of multiple use ag tens, a little bit of EFU, some surface mine. With the resort overlay, we don't really want to move forward with a resort application because we don't want the high densities that that would entail. We prefer to use the low density that would be allowed under the TDOs that were granted for the Metolius. We'd like to incorporate some of the agriculture as permanent sustained agriculture and protect it with conservation easements. The lodging would be designed as form and function rather than deed restrictions. We provided mitigation for the schools, economic mitigation. We provided public process through the site plan. And I realize that the time is getting short, but in short, the TDOs were created on the state level, and it was a recommendation of Representative Clem that instead of a set-off program, that we actually amend the TDO legislation to allow for placement on our property instead of something separate. And I know some of the comments that you've had have expressed concern over open space and the fact that some of it is represented to be permanent open space. I have a copy of the open space document if anyone would like that clearly states that it would apply until the property is, or the open space is superseded by future approvals. There's been concern about wildlife. I have a wildlife inventory that shows a developed property is has as much or more wildlife as the undeveloped. Also, the CCNRs that everybody signed on to when they bought the property explicitly states that they consent to future approval and development. And I'd be happy to answer any questions anybody has, but...
Okay, we'll go to the next person, Mr. Lundgren, and then if people have questions, then we'll take questions.
Good afternoon, Chairman and committee members. I'm Shane Lundgren from Camp Sherman, Oregon. My family's been there since the early 1920s. My great-grandfather, John Zenbauer, who founded Janssen, bought it as a summer home. And I've been co-manager of Dutch Pacific Resources, LLC, and the developer of the proposed Metolian Eco Resort. So the Metolian proposal, you may remember, brought to the table some of the most advanced ideas in sustainable development from a global team. The detailed technical work that went into the project brought about 50 high-level engineers, land planners, water and waste specialists, and architects to the project. The collaboration was nothing short of a marvel, and it kind of took on a life of its own, far removed from the battle that my partner Jim Keane and I were involved in, which was more on the political side over here. Since then, I've had hundreds of people coming up expressing disappointment and not seeing some of these ideas pass, as it could have offered the state some new and fresh energy, perspectives, and people who could have added value by their interaction and interest with the Metolius Basin. But I also want to acknowledge the fact that as policymakers for the state of Oregon, you're trying to do the right thing in a fair and balanced manner, and I appreciate that. So as compensation for thwarting the Metolian and its advanced state of the DR mapping process, we were given transferable development opportunities, TDOs, by law in 2009. So as everyone here knows, it was a tough moment in Oregon's land use history, and I unfortunately found myself in the history books with the Rajneesh and Dorothy England, where I didn't really want to be. So at this point in time, I'm curious to know if the TDO legislation is sincere. Does the legislature indeed desire to see these development credits placed, or is this a game to be played on an ever-changing field? So given the fact that Deschutes County could soon qualify for placement of the TDOs under the unemployment criteria outlined, we could have the support to utilize them on another site in Deschutes County, perhaps in an isolated forest zone land. So there are two ideal properties outside Sisters, aside from the Cyrus property, that could work for these TDOs. And my point is that they're going to land somewhere in Oregon. It could be in your home district, but there will certainly be anxiety over where they'll land until this is resolved. So the Aspen Lakes proposal seems to make sense. It was Clem's and Representative Huffman's idea to support this, It wasn't something we ginned up. I think it makes sense in that it resolves a lot of issues. It's small scale. Look at the big picture of what's going on in Oregon. Everybody's looking for jobs, revenue. This is a dying area economically. This is an opportunity to do something minimal impact in a property that's already more or less developed. This is a big shrinkage in the amount of development they would normally undergo with destination resort overlay. So the Cyruses have the opportunity to do it. They've been there 100 years. They've been stewards of the land. Or you will end up with a private equity firm from New York coming in, cramming the lots down everybody's throat, and you know, you'll have 3,000 lots there potentially. So I think it's a logical opportunity. I support it, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Holvey.
I'm curious, in this area, I'm not really this familiar with this project, but it seems like you're proposing a relatively urbanized area out there. And where do you get the figures for how, the, I mean, you must foresee some sort of success for this. And, you know, if you say the economy's bad, where are people going to get the money to move in here? And how's this pan out, I guess?
Vice Chair, can I answer that? Right now, we're in a very desirable area. The Aspen Lakes development is currently a very desirable place for people to move. We have some very nice homes. It's an area that is sought after. Within a one-mile radius around the developed property, we counted 750 existing home sites. So even though it looks pretty rural, there is a lot of development in the Sisters area. Most of the existing lots have been absorbed over the last, most of the developments were pretty well built out. Black Butte's pretty well built out. Eagle Crest is mostly built out. There's demand for what we would propose to offer. And from a density standpoint, under current resort rules, there is a minimum density of half-acre lots. So the 1,500 acres that we're proposing to develop could potentially be developed with several thousand home sites, where what we're asking for is simply to use the 480 TDOs. And as an example, or as a comparison, a subdivision that was recently approved in Sisters, it's currently under development, constituted 400 home sites on 40 acres. And so we're looking for a very low density, and that's specifically why we don't want to go through the resort process, because it would require much higher densities.
Madam Chair, if I might, Representative Holvey, to get to your question, the unemployment rate still continues to be quite high in Deschutes County. However, a lot of these home sites, as have been filled in by Eagle Crest, Aspen Lakes, Black Butte Ranch, and others, it's a desirable place for folks to move into for retirement and other purposes, and so the money would come in from the outside and bolster the economy. So that's, I think, the comment about right. The economy, why would we be doing the home sites? It wouldn't necessarily be I'll probably buy the first one, but other than that, it wouldn't necessarily be that much local money that may buy the places. It could be a lot of out-of-state money coming in, as has been historic.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. The bill creates a new category of development, Heritage Guest Ranch. Could you explain that? I mean, why are we creating a new entity in the state? And do you see this being something that will be replicated? I mean, will we be seeing Heritage Guest Ranches in downtown Portland? No, probably not.
Well, a little bit of background on this. I sat in on the resort work group that Senator Dingfelder convened a couple of years ago and listened to the concerns that were being posed by environmental organizations, League of Cities, the county organization, all the different groups. And a lot of those things actually had a lot of merit. For example, the cities were concerned about impacts without the ability to have influence on neighboring projects. You had people talking, people been talking school SDCs for years, environmental impacts. lodging, form and function over deed restrictions. So we thought, well, even though nothing came out of that, no legislation moved forward from that work group, we thought a lot of the comments made sense, and so we incorporated a lot of those into this development concept in what we consider the next generation prototype of a development that maybe can and should be done in the future. Maybe a step back to the family-oriented that made Black Butte Ranch and Sun River successful versus the ultra mega resort gated communities that they're super exclusive. You know, we're looking for something that's a step back to maybe what it should be instead of what it's morphed into. And so, yeah, we think that we have hopefully come up with a concept that maybe can be replicated.
Okay.
But however, if I could just follow up, but the bill is really specific to this project, is it not? As I look at it, there are some specificities, actually. As I look at it closely, Deschutes County next to Wycus Creek, I guess.
And that is correct. In order to not make it so broad that we generate a lot of opposition from everybody saying we'd have huge impacts all over the state, if you're going to do a test site, it made, you know, similar. I mean, the Sylvius was very specific, as are some of these others. We thought we'd give it a shot and see what happened.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'm curious about the land. You had mentioned that a lot of this is farmland, and so I'm curious what the crops are that are in this area, and is this project going to, I guess, supplant that farmland?
Actually, Central Oregon is a very marginal crop area. Years ago, our family used to raise seed potatoes and mint and some of those things. Right now, with the market conditions, transportation, other parts of the country are so much more competitive. The primary crops in our community, because of the number of frost-free days, etc., are pretty limited, primarily hay and grain. And it's with the deed restrictions that are proposed in the legislation, it would protect and keep the land under agriculture in perpetuity. You know, as is, those fields could be developed as small farmsteads. Our goal is to keep it open space and keep it protected in agriculture. It's been in our family for over 50 years. A lot of the fields were cleared by my family. Dad spent a lot of hours on a dozer making those fields. There's a lot of heart, blood, sweat, and tears into that land, and we want to keep it as nice as we possibly can. We don't want to bottom line is it's no longer viable for agriculture. We can't afford the losses that it sustains on an annual basis, and if we don't do something different with it, we'll have to sell it to somebody else who will.
Any other questions, comments?
Mr. Manager,
yes.
It would be helpful if somebody pointed to this map and actually showed us what we're looking at.
Oh, okay.
The maps are wonderful,
I'm not sure what. This is the general sister's area. Can we ask to have the maps where everybody can see them?
Well, we can't see them.
Sure.
Okay.
I'll move down. He'll turn them around.
Yeah, he'll turn them around just as soon as he's done. So.
Okay. The first map is the general sisters area. This is sisters.
Be quick.
Yes.
Please be quick.
The Aspen Lakes Golf Course is right here. The proposed development, and actually, we'll move to the second map, which is blown up, easier to see. This is just a general area of the sisters. This is Aspen Lakes. This property is zoned RR10 with a resort overlay. This is the Wycus Creek, which we own. This property would be transferred to a nonprofit environmental organization as part of the plan for permanent preservation. This is where the Aspen Lakes Golf Course is. This, everything down here in orange, is part of the existing farm. of which the fields would be protected in a conservation easement. These other areas, you know, any construction would be back in the trees and the brush and less visible to anybody driving by.
That was all I needed.
All right, thank you.
These are pictures of the meadow that would be converted to conservation. These are a couple pictures of the area to be developed, the existing clubhouse, and right now a lot of the use of the canyon has primarily been to school groups doing environmental assessment down there.
Great. Thank you very much. And
thank you, Madam Chair.
Appreciate it. Okay, we have a lot of people still yet to speak on this bill. We're going to go a bit over for our committee, and I'm going to call people who've come from over 100 miles away first, because that seems like the right thing to do. So Deirdre Thompson, Thomas Thompson, and Paul Dewey. Okay. Ms. Thompson, please identify yourself.
Sure. Deirdre Thompson, I live in Aspen Lakes, and I have submitted written testimony, so I know you have a busy time when you're running a little bit late, so I'm going to just defer to other people who are submitting testimony.
Oh, thank you very much, and thank you for coming all this way.
Sure.
Sir, please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Paul Dewey. I'm the Executive Director of Central Oregon Land Watch, and I've been practicing land use for 20, 25 years. And I have to say, what you're going through now is what the Deschutes County Planning Commission, the hearings officer, and the Board of County Commissioners would go through. And with all due respect, I know your plate is full as it is with legislation. But where this belongs properly under our system, under our land use system, is before the elected officials of Deschutes County, who would have not only these maps, but also analyses by the staff of Deschutes County examining potential impacts, transportation impacts, wildlife corridors. You just aren't equipped for this one-off kind of legislation to really consider all the issues that are naturally part of our land use process. And it really is for the Board of County Commissioners, and I believe they stated this in their letter to you, the Deschutes County Code should be followed. The procedures ordinance should be followed. All of the zoning should be followed. You can't, obviously you can legislate a number of things, one-off legislation, but this is just really bad policy. And you're going to hear a lot of dispute about what are the effects of past decisions of the Board of County Commissioners, whether or not there's required open space. All of that is for Deschutes County to decide. They made those decisions, and you should allow them to interpret their own decisions rather than by legislative fiat, which is really this bill. And I see my caution light is on. I just want to add one more thing regarding the TDOs. I was involved in 2009 during all the Metolius litigation, then legislation. And that was a very specific compromise that is being broken with this legislation. As Mr. Lundgren testified, there were a number of very important components to that TDO. No golf course, but with this bill, you would have a golf course. $1.5 million was to be donated for off-site restoration of public lands. Nothing of that here. It was only to involve 320 acres. This involves over 1,000 acres. The TDO for the Metolius said 240 units. This is up to 600 units. So this is completely inconsistent with the compromise that was reached in the legislature in 2009. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for letting me testify. I will briefly summarize my testimony and have provided the information in writing. I'm Thomas Thompson. I'm a resident of the Cyrus Development in Aspen Lakes Golf Course. I live at 17100 Goldenstone Drive. And I'll be directly impacted by this legislation if it's passed. I follow the Cyrus family's attempts to develop their land for the last 4 or 5 years and find myself in the awkward position of being opposed to this bill, whereas I've supported the Cyrus family's attempt to develop their land previously before Deschutes County. My objection to this is that it is a single piece of legislation, special interest, and I believe that the planning process belongs in the county level, not in the state legislature. I have other reasons that I have a problem with this, but you'll find those in writing. And I would ask that you table this bill, not pass it out of committee. With that, you have the rest of my testimony in writing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, I would like to call Susan Trask, Pam Mitchell, and, although not from 100 miles away, but part of the same panel, Dave Honeycutt.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Susan Trask. I am a broker with Cascade Sotheby's International Realty in Sisters. Thank you for taking the time to hear this today. I moved to Central Oregon in 2005, brought my family here, and I did so for many of the reasons that I believe House Bill 3536 should be supported. This would open up more of what I came to Central Oregon and what I see in the real estate industry, why people do want to come to Central Oregon. It's a lifestyle, and it is housing that is affordable when people are coming in from out of state where prices have got egregiously high. We have seen in Deschutes County over the last 6 months a significant uptick in real estate sales. Absorption rates, which are the number of listings based on the amount of time that it takes to sell, are diminishing on a weekly basis. We see it every Wednesday morning in our sales meetings. The bulk of that is happening in the lower end, that's obvious, but it's moving up the scale quickly. Whereas 9-10 months ago, that was under $300,000, now it's up into the $600,000 and $700,000 range. More and more we are seeing or hearing people in our industry saying, we don't have any inventory to sell. The Cyrus development or proposal to move this forward would absolutely afford not only people to be able to purchase in there and build in there, it would also greatly help with the unemployment problems we are having in Central Oregon. It will create jobs, it will help with the revenue, and it will help with property values. I just absolutely can't see a downside to it. I can only see positives with respect to the real estate industry and employment and revenue for Sisters and for the Deschutes County. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Ma'am?
Hi, I'm Pam Mitchell, and I am part of the Aspen Lakes development. I'm a Cyrus, so I'm incognito with the last name of Mitchell. Thank you for taking the time today to hear this. We do appreciate it. To start out with, I guess I find it a little ironic that cities and counties all over the state and all over the country are offering crazy incentives for businesses to move into their area for economic development. We are a business that has been in place, our family's been in Central Oregon for six generations. We plan to stay in Central Oregon. We want Central Oregon to be prosperous, and we want it to do that in a very responsible manner. We are here in front of you today because the TDOs were developed on a state level. The counties cannot make changes on those. It is up to the state legislature to make changes on how those TDOs are placed and if there's any changes in how they are dealt with. We actually think it's more responsible to put those TDOs on property that has development rights on it already. And ours actually has a couple sets of development rights, either RR10 or with the destination resort overlay. The infrastructure is already in place. The tax base would help our schools. And our schools are suffering right now. We're losing kids on a regular basis, and we'd like to see the tax base shored up so that we can improve the situation that's there. And I guess the question is, at what time do we close the door? Is it when the last homeowner comes in, or is it when the next person wants to come in?
I could have wanted the door closed a long time ago. But, you know, I think we need to provide the opportunity for people to come to an area and do it in a responsible manner. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Mr. Honeycutt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of House Bill 3536. We used to, around these parts, when I first started lurking in the halls down here, we would pass every year a blub, a big land use bill. We quit passing blubs around here a few sessions ago, and now we're passing slubs, which are small land use bills, and this is an example of a slub. I agree with Mr. Dewey on the last panel that it would be nice if land use decisions were made at the local level. That's the best place to do that, and we'd be completely supportive of a bill that had all land use decisions made at the local level, but we kind of lost that argument in 1973 with the passage of Senate Bill 100. And this bill, which is sort of the irony of this bill makes changes to the Matolius legislation, which was another example of a one-off bill that deals with one particular area of the state and asked the legislature to act as, essentially in that case, the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners. So that happens in this building all the time. The reason we think this bill is important is because of the transferable development opportunity section of the or part of the bill. TDRs, transferable development rights, transferable development opportunities are a planning tool that have never really worked very well because you don't have, you have a lot of rights but very few landing places for those TDRs, and so the program has never worked very well. This was a specific, the legislature authorized these TDO opportunities. In order to show that that program can actually work, we need to have some legislation where TDOs or TDRs actually are put into, are cited in a spot and actually developed, and this bill is an example that will do that. We're very supportive of the bill and commend it to the committee and hope that with the amendments that you'll move it along, and I know it's late in the session, but do what you can to see if we can get this going.
Great. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Any questions for the panel? No comments? Excellent. Thank you very much. Okay. Next three people, Paul Lipscomb, David Lee, and Whitney Lowe. And then after that, we'll be calling Taylor Robinson, Rob Malone, and Elise Wolf. So.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for your patience and for giving us this time here today. My name is Paul Lipscomb, and our home is located just outside of Sisters, Oregon at 169991 Bartlemy Lane. And our property, as you'll see in this first exhibit here, is quite literally surrounded by all the various Cyrus family properties. Proposed for this development. We're kind of within an enclave or island community within the overall surroundings of the Cyrus properties. My wife Donna and I purchased this property in 2004 with the idea of building our retirement home there. I retired from the Marion County Circuit Court in 2008. We planned our home, we designed our home, we built our home on that property so that we could retire there and live out our lives at that location. Before doing so, because it was quite an expensive undertaking, I personally researched the surrounding zoning to ensure that there were no danger signs of imminent development on the horizon. I knew that if we were going to make that kind of financial commitment, it was going to be a commitment that would be with us for the rest of our lives, and I wanted to make sure that that was a safe and wise investment. I was also, because I had served as a hearings officer both in the Salem area where we were living at that time and in the city of Kaiser, I knew a lot about land use law, and I knew that irrigated farmlands were very well protected by Oregon land use statutes and by the LCDC goals and guidelines. And so I really felt that our investment there was a wise and prudent and permanent one. HB 3536 puts our own investment at great risk. And I want you to know this, and, folks.
And we do ask, we have a lot of people that we need to testify, sir, so we do ask you.
And if I just may, you've heard a lot of promises and people pointing to things on the exhibits here. None of that is in writing. What's written in this bill gives carte blanche to develop all of these acres, whether irrigated or not irrigated. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Sir. Chairman, my name is David Lee. I reside here in Salem, Oregon, but I also own a lot, Lot 12, Remet Aspen Lakes in Sisters, Oregon. As far as background, I am a registered professional civil engineer, a registered environmental engineer, a registered land surveyor, and a certified water rights examiner. And I have practiced engineering in the state of Oregon for over 40 years. I have a personal interest in the project because I own property there and I've followed it from its inception. I first had interest in the property beginning in 1989 and followed it throughout the development of Aspen Lake four phases and the Rim and Aspen Lakes. I'll quickly add my name to the chorus of those that will declare that these two projects, Remet Aspen Lakes and the golf course estates at Aspen Lakes, are completed subdivision under the county ordinances for clustered subdivisions. And as part of that process, there was open space created, and that open space should be preserved and cannot be part of the lands included in this proposed development. More specifically, the language of the proposed legislation makes reference to a segment of Wyches Creek floodplain and proposed spawning beds that will become an element of if it's environmental enhancement. This section of Wyches Creek is Track B of the Rim and Aspen Lake subdivision and is already designated as open space. It is also a segment of a state waterway, and the Deschutes County Comprehensive Plan produces a landscape overlay on the property, which further reduces any uses on the property. In 1991-92, additional deed restrictions were filed with the county, which limits its use to passive outdoor recreation and wildlife habitat.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony, sir. Is there a final statement you want to leave us with?
Well, my final statement has to do with the overall project, and I have submitted this in writing, and you'll have an opportunity to review that. But basically, I strongly recommend that you not pass this legislation.
Okay, and thank you for coming here today.
Please. Thank you, Madam Chair. The rest of the committee, my name is Whitney Lowe. I am a business owner and a resident in the Sisters area. It's been a long-established policy that issues of land use and planning have the greatest impact on local communities, and consequently, the state has structured a process to elicit that degree of input, and with this project, it really feels like there is an end run around that process, specifically to benefit one particular constituent, and that feels very unjust in this particular instance, so I'd like to add my voice to those in opposition to it. Another issue of concern here is the circumventing of the water rights process. There's a reason for these land use codes and laws because they provide an avenue to make sure that things are done in an appropriate fashion. Every other property owner in this area must abide by the rules that have been developed for over the by the legislature from years of looking at this process. And we all know what's coming down the pike in this general area in the Cascades with a lack of water for Deschutes and Jefferson counties, decreasing snowpack, warmer winters, hotter summers. There's going to be water issues in this area. And the way in which this is being structured in this particular bill to give carte blanche to the property owners for however they choose to make use of those water rights is highly troubling. One other thing struck my attention, and I'll try to be brief here again, too. Towards the end of the bill, there were a series of requirements listed that suggested how the property owners would attempt to mitigate numerous adverse environmental impacts of this development. And yet, just above that, it said in the guidelines that they may submit a plan to the county for a master plan, which the county shall approve as long as the owner demonstrates an intention to substantially comply with those requirements. Suggest that they don't have to comply, they just have to demonstrate a substantial an intention to comply. And that's highly troubling, because you could get away with just not doing anything at all, just saying you intended to but didn't do it after all. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Next are Taylor Robertson, Rob Malone, and Elise Wolf. And after that will be Jerry Norquist, Richard Kyle, and is it Mr. Jellin? Kerry Jellin? Okay, please proceed.
Would you like please? To go first?
Please. Proceed.
Me? All right. My name is Elise Wolf. I own 40 acres in the Sisters area, and I also near the Wychoose Creek, and I also am a licensed wildlife rehabilitator. First, there's a lot of contradictory statements being said. The area needs homes, but then the buyers are coming from out of state. They're losing kids in schools, but again, the kids are not going to be coming with those out-of-state vacation buyers. If they want the county to be involved, then why exempt the property and the bill from state land use laws and county codes and regulations? If the legislature worked hard to come up with a Metolius plan, now one family, just a couple of years later, wants to rewrite this legislature to fit their own needs. And the Aspen Lakes resorts, if they need lots, well, there's several left in there, because only 66 out of 115 lots are actually developed in there. And there is an educational program on the Wychoose Creek, but these are through two nonprofits who have spent millions of dollars buying the creek up for miles and then trying to reintroduce salmon and preserve the creek and restore it. What the problem is for me is, as a professional in wildlife conservation and rescue, I know for a fact that there are impacts to animals and the aquifer, and some of those impacts come from structures themselves. You can't build a house without having a bird strike it. How many here have had their bird strike a window? This creek mostly is at risk, because you're talking about non-point pollution sources. They're going to use fertilizers, pesticides, fungicides, herbicides on those golf courses. They're going to suck enough water to fill a lake out of the aquifer. They're going to convert surface water rights to groundwater rights, so we have no idea how much water is in there. And so my recommendation is that if we want to continue with this plan, Bring it home. Show the map that's going around right now, which isn't up here, by the way, and show where the 480 houses are going to go and where the lake and the golf course and everything are going to be, and get community input. Okay. Thank you.
Please.
Good afternoon, Chairman Hicks, members of the committee. Thank you for the time. My name is Rob Malone. I'm a resident of Sisters, have been for 14 years. I live in the property adjacent to Aspen Lakes. I do work at Aspen Lakes as well, but I come to you as a private citizen, fully supporting House Bill 3536. Being here for 14 years, raising three kids, I've seen the negative impact that Sisters has seen. If you drive through the town, you'll find an alarming number of empty businesses. My position is development takes place. It's required for you to continue to grow. I think the area can hugely use the economic shot in the arm. Looking at the possibilities for the future, I think this subdivision certainly would make more sense than a much larger one at some point in the future. I witness every day the stewardship the Cyruses take on the land, and I think even the homeowners that have testified today would agree that they take exceptional care of the land. Past performance is usually a fantastic indicator of future performance. In that, I have full confidence that they would take advantage of it. Please join me in supporting House Bill 3536.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Taylor Robertson. I live in Sisters. Let me tell you a little bit about what I'm not. I'm not a close friend of the Cyrus family. I don't live close to this development, proposed development. I don't have a dog in the fight, basically. I am not a member of any of the environmental groups and the development or anti-development groups that are here today. I'm a retired basic guy from Sisters. I can also see a lot of the reasons why there is opposition to this, particularly if it's close to your property, and if somebody wanted to do this in my backyard, I'd certainly have some concerns as well. But I think we need to look at this holistically. First of all, I've heard a lot of information that's conflicting. I think it's important for you to look closely at it. From what I have read, I do believe that the project has merit, and I believe that the impacts that many are concerned about are being mitigated with the legislation. I also believe in one very basic thing that I think it's important to remember. This country was built on the ability, within reason, for private landowners to be stewards of their land and to do with their land what's reasonable. There's the problem, there's the question. But our society has turned this into a free-for-all, where often special interests or one little faction can block this. And in my mind, it does come down to private property rights in some respects. And if all of the issues are addressed, I really believe that this project has merit and that you should consider this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Seeing none. Okay, thank you all for coming. Next is Jerry Norquist, Richard Kyle, and Jellin. Mr. and Ms. Jellin, Kerry. And after that will be Dennis McGregor, Pamela Burry, and Kathy Degendorfer. Please.
Chairman Hicks and committee, my name is Jerry Norquist. I live in Sisters, Oregon, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Oregon is considered to have one of the best land use policies in the country. I travel to D.C. often to talk to legislators, and our land use is well respected. Bill HB 3536, creating a heritage ranch designation, circumvents the normal land use process and uses the legislative process to benefit one family. I urge you to table this HB 3536 and allow local land use process to deal with this issue. Many of the other things that I wanted to talk about in terms of water and other things have already been addressed, so I'm going to give my time to the other people. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Richard Kleiss. I live in Central Oregon, probably about 20 minutes east of the Sisters area. I would urge you to support House Bill 3536. I am one of those people who feels that, by and large, resorts and similar developments have been good for Deschutes County. While there have been a few problems along the way, the economic diversification and tax revenues from resorts have left our county in much better shape financially than, say, Josephine and Curry counties. Others before me have spoken about the positive economic benefits, the chance to preserve a section of Whites Creek, and the fact that most of the land in question has already been zoned for residential development, so I'm not going to dwell on that. What I will say is this. I served for 4 years on the Deschutes County Planning Commission. One of the reasons why I left that commission was the realization that all too often Oregon's system of land use laws, whatever the original intention, has become a system of winners and losers. It is often not a system which encourages compromise. Positions harden, rhetoric escalates. Each side fights to the end, never attempting to work with the other side, because they know the winner will take it all. You have before you a bill which I believe is a decent compromise. The proponents will be able to proceed with their development, but not perhaps in the way they originally envisioned or with the density they might have wished. The opponents won't be able to stop the expansion, but they will be able to preserve a valuable section of riparian habitat and other things. Each side will give a little and take a little. They will compromise if you let them. Thank you.
Greetings, I'm Kimberly Gillen. I see most of the letters sent have already gone over the main issues of water and development. I mostly want to comment on the nature of how this bill has been introduced and claimed as an emergency. It doesn't leave an appropriate amount of time to consider all the major impacts. As an example, the bill was introduced on the 29th, and within a week already, it has been amended concerning water issues. I am a neighbor to the Cyruses, right next door. I'm one of the in-your-backyard people. I hear it's... I live where it's supposed to be designated open space. If you go to the county, it's on record as open space in perpetuity. Oh dear, now I can't say it, forever. And perpetuity. And I like the Cyruses, and I enjoy going to their restaurant, Brand 33. I have nothing against them. But I do want to say, just because someone buys the land, they keep commenting, in the newspaper, there was an article that stated that if they didn't develop it, somebody else would. Just because someone buys the land from them does not mean they can develop it. Oregon land use laws should apply. And if we're talking about what ifs, if this single family did get this bill passed, who's to say they wouldn't sell the development opportunity or get investors from some big company somewhere in New York or China? Sisters is a small, wonderful, desirable community. The development should be done in town, not outside of town. Please do not let HB 3536 go any further. It's riddled with all sorts of issues and needs more time.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Seeing none, okay. Thank you all.
Thank you.
And next is Dennis McGregor, Pamela Burry, and Kathy Degendorfer. And after that will be Janet Zolk and Peggy Lynch and Stephen Kafour. In any order, please. Yes.
Hi, I'm Kathy Degendorfer. I live in Sisters. I have the honor of owning the William T. E. Wilson Historic Homestead. It's bordered on two sides by Cyrus property, and we have the Whiteches Creek going through our property. My biggest concern here is the misuse of our land use laws. Sometimes I chafe under those land use laws as well, but I feel like I need to support them because we've all made commitments to each other to honor the legislation that has occurred in the past. I'm concerned about the transfer of these Matolian rights, mostly because the whole watershed area for this area, the two pieces of the lifeblood are the Whiteches Creek and the Matolius River. So we're talking about the same watershed that we just protected in 2009 and now transferring rights to a development in the other arm of this watershed. So I'm very much opposed to HB 3536, and I hope that we can table it here and that we can go back to local rule on this. Thank you very much.
Please.
Thank you for allowing all of us to have a voice today. I really appreciate that. My name is Pamela Burry. I live right outside of Sisters, about 6 miles. I drive by the designated area that we're talking about two to six times a day on my trips back and forth into town. I feel intimate with it in that way. I see the golf course 2 to 4 times a day that exists already. I drive by the Aspen Lakes current development many times a day and see what already exists and that functions as it is. Now we're proposing another golf course and more developments within that very close area. The biggest thing I want to say, with so much already being said, is this is beautiful country. This is beautiful existing Oregon land, high desert, along the Wychus Creek that feeds in to the watershed with the Metolius River. It is a really sacred country, and we are really lucky to be there with the Sisters Mountains behind. In between, farmland and open space, both of which are highly treasured, that means something to all of us. And the open space in particular, people who've been there a lot longer than I have, buying their land for particular reasons, knowing what's going to neighbor them for a long, long time to come. And in that vein, I would like to say that I highly am against 3536, and I hope you will table it ASAP. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Hi, Dennis McGregor here from Sisters. I live on property that's next door to the Cyrus's proposed development land. Before buying that land and building my home, I went to the county and asked who owns that land and what can happen there. And I was informed that it was designated open space not to be built upon, which served my interest because I moved from an overdeveloped area of Southern California and I wanted to live out in the country. That's why I bought the land and built there. And so I'm opposed to this bill. Other folks have enumerated reasons which I agree with. And I would like to say that I also represent the opinion of many neighbors and friends who are not able to make the trip over here today at a short notice. And thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for this panel? Okay, I don't see any, so thank you for coming. And next on are Janet Zolke. Janet Zolke and Peggy Lynch and Stephen Kafori. And afterwards will be Tom Ryan Wrights, Jim Myron, and Steve McCoy. I don't see Kafori or Lynch here. So, okay. Let me cite those three names again. So we have Mr. Tom. Is it Riatz? Wrights? Tom?
Ryan.
Ryan?
Tom Ryan.
Yeah.
They've gone into the overflow room. Okay, so we'll give him those. So it's Tom Ryan, perhaps. And Mr. Myron, there's a Jim Myron, and Steve McCoy. Okay. Please start with your name, please.
Yes. Thank you. My name is Tom Ryan. I'm an attorney. I live in Portland. I have a cabin at Camp Sherman on the Metolius River, and I'm also on the board of Friends of the Metolius. And we, as Friends of Metolius, opposes this bill because of the changes from the original concept back when it was going to be the Metolian, because there's just too much left open as far as understanding what it is that the bill is going to do. For instance, you have the up to 600 units on 1,000 acres, and then it could be more than that, plus it could be 100 spaces for motor coaches, plus more as far as lodgings. Also, as an attorney, I really was surprised to read this statement that common ownership means ownership by related family members or by entities owned by related family members. It seems very inappropriate to me for the legislature to be making decisions for the benefit of one particular family. It's sort of like feudalism, where the nobles got to run the land and the king got the tax, and that was the way it is. But it just seems very unusual for this to be. I mean, suppose somebody else comes down here and says, well, I want for my family this and that. Is that the legislature's, is that what you want to do? I mean, it just seems very unusual. Everything else, it seems to me that I had to say, I think, been covered, so thank you very much.
Chair Hicks, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy representing 1000 Friends of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in opposition to HB 3536. I have submitted written testimony, so I will not rehash that. However, I would like to talk about a few things that have been discussed. One was Mr. Cyrus said that the reason for this bill was...
Please continue. Please continue.
Yeah, okay. The reason for this bill was because the destination resort law required too much density. There is nothing that I'm aware of within the destination resort law that requires a particular density. In fact, it's kind of the other way around, where there is a minimum parcel size, but there is no maximum size. The other thing that was mentioned was that soon these could be, these transfer development opportunities could be transferred to Deschutes County because it was going to meet the unemployment, I guess, actually, numbers. That was mentioned as well in the first panel. However, the TDOs can only be transferred to counties that met that at a date certain, June 29th, 2009. So it's not like suddenly Deschutes County is going to become eligible for these. Finally, one of the, I guess the realtor mentioned that unemployment was really, really bad in the area and that this would increase employment. However, there are thousands of platted lots in destination resorts in Central Oregon that are not built upon. Creating more platted lots will not magically create jobs. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for this panel? There are none. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next is Tom Wolf, Jonathan Madden, and is that the end of the list?
Yes.
Okay. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill that I have not called or whose name I mispronounced? Okay. Oh, okay, please. Yes. You can come on up. Come on up, please, sir. And in the meantime...
Oh. Chair Hicks, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the Executive Director Chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I'm here representing the 3,000 members of Trout Unlimited here in the state and the 500 that live in the Bend Sisters Redmond area. We are opposed to this bill, and I'm going to be very brief. Of course, we're worried about the impact that this will have on Whitechief's Creek, which is one of the major restoration projects going on in this part of the state that both salmon and steelhead have been reintroduced to in the state, and groups like Trout Unlimited are spending millions of dollars on to recover that. Any resort you have there will have an impact on the table. Second is this should be handled on the local county areas. Many people have brought that up. I'm a great believer in that we shouldn't be using the legislators for end runs in whatever decisions are made, whether it be decisions by agencies or decisions by land boards. So we oppose this bill and urge you not to vote it out of committee. Thank you.
Members of the committee, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. My name is Jonathan Manton, and I represent Central Oregon Land Watch as well as Friends of the Metolius. Thanks to each of you for being here late this afternoon. A lot of folks have come a long way, and so we really appreciate you being able to stay and hear from all of them on this. It's an issue that's very important to a lot of people. I want to turn our attention to the language that's actually in the bill so that you can be aware of what you would be voting on should this come up. Section 3 talks about the applicant may establish the recreational community on a heritage guest ranch as an outright permitted use, and it says, notwithstanding contrary provisions of five different chapters of Oregon law. So this says, notwithstanding five chapters of Oregon law, you can go ahead and do this. So this is saying you don't have to comply with the land use laws of this state. Look at those five different chapters and what you're exempting this one family from having to comply with. First would be the chapter ORS 195 is local government planning coordination. Included in that are things like Measure 37, and there's a litany of regulations and rules that would apply just within that. You wouldn't have to comply with removal fill mitigation rules, for example. You wouldn't have to comply with wetland conservation plans. Chapter 197 is our comprehensive land use planning coordination. That's basically our entire land use system that they would be exempted from complying with. That's literally our land use system does not apply to this one entity. That's the Land Conservation and Development Commission. That's LC, the Department of Land Conservation and Development. It's comprehensive plan. There's a comp plan already in place in this area. That's goals with our land use system. So goal one is citizen participation, happens to be my favorite. They wouldn't have to comply with any of that under this section. Okay, we're writing an entire new land use system just for the Cyrus family with this bill. And then last, and I only have a second more, I want to respond to Mr. Honeycutt's mention of the Metolius legislation that was passed back in 2009, and what a contrast that was to this. So in that case, yes, the state stepped in and said we're going to put a new management plan in place for the Metolius. But before that got to the state legislature, the Land Conservation and Development Commission held 4 public hearings throughout the state, 3 in Central Oregon, where there were hundreds, if not thousands, of comments taken on the proposed changes to the local plan. So people, the department said, here's a prospective new regime for this area. The public got to weigh in on it. The department then changed it in response to those comments and concerns, presented another management plan. The public weighed in again. They revised it a second time. Then there was a public vote of the Land Conservation and Development Commission as to whether or not to recommend the legislature do an area of critical state concern. So the agency said, after all of that public comment and 4 public hearings out in the area where it impacts people the most, then the officials of LCDC said, yes, we're going to take a vote publicly and say we recommend to the legislature to step in and do an area of critical state concern.
Okay.
All of that public process. Contrast that to here, where you have one bill written by one entity to benefit one family.
Got it. Okay. Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. I'm Keith Sires. I'm part of that, that group off the other side of the fence. But just a little hit and miss, some of the background of this. Our home farm, which Kai and I acquired in 1972, shares a mile of common fence with this property. And my first involvement with this property was when I was on the water board in what was the Squaw Creek Irrigation District. And it came before us, and our request to the developers at that time, the request was to set back the lots from the irrigation canal that went through there. But that's the only involvement I know of at that time. But as time went by, we were invited to develop it for other people. And in being on the property, we recognized what a special piece of real estate it was. It was a platted 10-acre subdivision. And we thought, gee, what a shame, you know. I've got subdivisions on the north side of me. I got subdivisions on the east side. The kids get into the equipment. They vandalize it. Their dogs get into our livestock. You know, I hate to have to shoot their pets because they're killing our sheep. But so be it. That's the way the law is. And so anyway, when we got involved with the property, it had laid idle for 10 years from the gentleman that owned it. And as we looked at it, one of the things we noticed was there are several lots were designated to be on the creek. And the family said, you know, that's not right. They can't be. The first thing we have to do is protect the creek. There have been no livestock on the creek since our ownership. And they were being challenged to not care for it. We care for it very much. It's very special. It's unique to have a say in that. But obviously, we took the building credits off the creek. There were building credits out on the Highway 126, visible to everybody. I don't remember just how many, but there are several. And our thing is, we don't want homes out where people are going to drive by and be seeing them. So,
thank you. Okay.
That's great. Where we're at.
So, I appreciate everybody coming this great distance that you've come for this hearing, and I wish you all safe journeys back, and hope your experience in Salem was not too harsh. So, with that having been said, I close the public hearing on House Bill 3536. And being no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.
Thank you.